Okay, so it's so nice to see all of you, and I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead. I'll find my notes while you're in. Okay.
So we're very privileged, as I see everybody realizes by showing themselves tonight, to have Mrs. Manis in our presence, in our midst. I personally feel like Mrs. Manis' last big visit to Denver, what, 15 years ago or so?
I don't remember.
Actually, for me, was really life-changing. It made a great imprint on me personally. And I think that what Mrs. Manis will share with us will speak for itself. But I think that we have a great fortune to have a person before us who combines living Torah with being very much a part of the world in a way that we can all learn something. It's not going to be out of our reach, I believe, but very much something to reach for. So please join me in welcoming Mrs. Manis.
Thank you. I feel so welcomed, Abigail. It's so nice to be here again. I do remember, I think, giving classes here many years ago. I can't remember quite how long ago. I would like to believe I'm still as young as I was 15 years ago, but somehow I think I have aged a bit since then. But it is wonderful to be back here, I have to say. Really, really wonderful. And it's so nice to see so many new faces in Denver. I cannot get over the growth of your community. We were in the Southeast for Shabbos, and it's unbelievable to see what Aisha has done there. And the Kollel has done there, and to meet the Kollel families there together with the H people, it was just very, very beautiful. And it's so nice to see some familiar faces. Some of you have been at the sessions that I did over Shabbat, session that I did this morning. So there will be a little overlap. If some of you don't mind hearing it again, I do hope you'll forgive me for that. Our topic tonight, Chinuch in out-of-town communities. So first I have to decide what out-of-town means. Okay, is Chicago out-of-town? Well, guess what? Chicago used to be the desert, the Midbar Shmama. Somebody told me recently that Chicago ranks second to New York, and I was like, and Lakewood. I was like, what? You don't mean that. I was like flabbergasted because I grew up in Chicago. And now they're telling me that Chicago's not really out of town anymore. So I was like, okay, I guess it can happen anywhere. So you never know. Denver might come in as third in a year or two. You never know, right? Okay, but first I had to identify this out of town piece because, yes, I am an out of towner, born and bred, born in Cleveland, raised in Chicago. My whole life, lived in New York for a little bit after we were married for a few years, but basically I've been born and bred in the Midwest, and really that's where I come from. That's where my roots are. And so out of town is its own reality. Let's face that, okay? And so we can look at other situations. I have a student in Eretz Yisrael who is such a wonderful, wonderful mother, and she told me about it. She lives in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and she was telling me about her daughter's siddur when they gave out siddur, Misibat Siddur, or whatever they call it there. And she was telling me that on the day her daughter got her siddur, she took her from Beit Shemesh to the Kostel to daven for the first time from her siddur at the Kostel. And then she took her to Rav Zin Kanievsky for a bracha. This is, of course, a number of years ago. She took her to Rav Zin Kanievsky. She spent her day going from Ramat Beit Shemesh to Yerushalayim to Bnei Brak, back to Ramat Beit Shemesh. It was an entire day. What she did with her other children, I do not know, but it was this mother and her little yummy six-year-old daughter going on the day of her Misipat Siddur. I was so overcome with emotion that a mother could do that, that the day that her daughter receives a siddur, and this will be imprinted in this child for the rest of her life at Mount Tefillah, that the first time she davened from a siddur was at the Kostel, and that she got a bracha from no one less than Rebbe Kanievsky herself, and the understanding of how chashuv Tefillah is came from Rebbe Kanievsky on that very day. And I thought to myself, oh, I would do anything to have been able to do that for my children. And then I said to myself, okay, now lady, you are going to shift gears and realize you don't live in Eretz Yisrael. Let's understand it. You do not live there, as much as I have longed to live there for my entire life, but you don't live there. You live right here in Chicago, Illinois, in the Midwest, and let's deal with that reality. So sometimes we spend a lot of time worrying about every place else that we could be raising our children, would be raising our children, and maybe my sister-in-law lives in Passaic, she does it like this, and my brother who lives in Lakewood, it's like this, and we kind of have this complex about in town, and we're very worried about it. We're really worried about it. Okay, so we have to understand. I'm sorry.
I don't.
You don't worry. Maybe you can come.
Out of town is a New York phrase. They're the center and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Now Lakewood. So I'm a Montrealer.
And you don't have, okay, that's great. I can sit down right now. But I would, by the way, welcome. What? I would welcome any comments and questions. We would like to open this up to questions afterwards, absolutely, and I would like to hear your insights and comments. Actually, I would like to see by a show of hands, who here is from the East Coast? From the East Coast. I didn't even say in town. I just said the East Coast, okay. And who here is a Denver native? Like born and bred Denver. There's a few of you, aren't there? Okay. Anybody else? Well, that is wonderful. Look at all these generations of Denver coming together. And what about Midwest? Anybody here from the Midwest? Okay. Anybody from the West? West Coast? That's you. Okay. You still look like your heart belongs on the West Coast. Somewhat. Okay. So we do have quite a representation of different places. And what we do have to say, while I am saying we cannot live the reality of another place where maybe we grew up and now we're there, they did it like this, and my brother and my sister-in-law and all the rest of it, we do have to realize that the place we live does make a difference. The sfiva we raise our children in does make a difference. And we can't just ignore that reality either and say, well, it doesn't matter where I am, Yerushalayim or Denver or Los Angeles or Montreal, it's all one and the same. It isn't, okay? Not to say that that should make us feel bad, but to say that let's look at where we are and let's deal with where we are, and then let's try to figure out what we're going to do about it. So I want to just go back quite a while to when I was in high school, when Chicago really was out of town at that point, very out of town. And I went to a school that was called the Ida Crown Jewish Academy Girls High School. It was not a Beis Yaakov by anyone's stretch of the imagination. We did not have a principal for the first 2.5 years that I was in the school. The math teacher kind of ran the school. It was a really interesting place. I had girls in my class who, during class, would be sitting and crocheting kippot for their boyfriends with the boyfriend's name, Michael and Tani and whatever the names were, and they were crocheting kippot. The accepted mode of dress when I was in high school was 4 inches above the knee. Okay, accepted mode of dress. Anybody my age will identify with that. Accepted mode of dress. In my school, the argument was, is there any halakhic difference between a skirt 4 inches above the knee and 2 inches above the knee? That was hot talk in my school. That was the hawk of the girls. It was really a debate. The girls who wore 4 inches above the knee said no difference. The girls who wore 2 inches said no. We are more theistic than you are, 2 inches above the knee. Okay, and the girls who wore their skirts to the middle of the knee were the Rebbetzins of the century. Oh my goodness, you couldn't get more from me than that. That was about it. Okay. So here I am, ninth grade in this school. I come from a so-called, whatever word we want to use it, a family of yeshivish, B'nai Torah. My father is a Rosh Yeshiva. I'm only saying that just to give you a little perspective here. And I am the oldest daughter in my family. Here I am coming into this school. And just to give you a little bit of an... Okay, I won't say history, whatever. Anyways, ninth grade, my French teacher, 4 years of French, that I took, I wrote a French book report. By the time I finished senior year, I was fluent in French. Ask me if I remember. Don't ask me if I remember. But my French teacher comes in when I was in ninth grade, and she says that she's taking the French class to a French movie in the movie theater. That's what she's doing. That's the activity next week, next French class. That's what we'll be doing. Her name was Giselle. I was Caroline. We all have these French names, and she's taking the French class. Okay, I came home, didn't say a word to my parents, not a word. The phone starts ringing. Rabbi Keller, are you sending your daughter to the French movie in the French theater? In the movie theater? And the next call comes in. Oh, so Rabbi Keller, what are your plans about this French movie? I had 10 girls in my class. About 6 of them had they didn't have their father's call. They went home and told their parents they were going, which I did not, and their fathers were soon on the phone. And I was so upset. Why does everybody have to call you? Why can't they make up their minds on their own? Why do they have to know from you what they're going to do with their children? Let them decide how they want to raise their own children. What does it have to do with us? Why did they have to call you anyways? I'm not sure if I was planning to tell my parents that there was a French movie. I probably would have at some point, because I probably would have just been felt a little too guilty, right? I probably would have, but I had not told them at that point. That was for sure. And the tears started, and I was crying, and my father sat down with me and spent a good part of an hour and a half sitting and talking to me. And it wasn't, no, you're not going, and this is what our family does, and we have to represent Torah in the city. Not at all. It was a conversation with a ninth grader on the level of a ninth grader, showing me that he really cared, and he cared a lot, and he loved me very much, and it came out in the conversation. He said it a few times, and he validated the fact that it was so hard for me that I wasn't going to be able to do this. But bottom line, I wasn't going to be able to do this. That was the bottom line here. It wasn't a matter of, so I want to give you the choice, and I'll trust whatever decision you make. No, no, no. That wasn't happening. It was very clear to me from the beginning of the conversation that I wasn't going. But an hour and a half of spending with this very, very angry, defiant 13-and-a-half-year-old who wanted very badly to prove that she did not want to be labeled as so-and-so's daughter for 4 years of high school, which is exactly what I was labeled as for 4 years of high school. Okay, so I do remember that my father must have bribed me a little bit at that time, too. I think there was something I got in return for not going to that French movie, if I remember correctly, but what came across to me very clearly was there is a standard in this family, and we are going to uphold this standard, but I care. I care very deeply about you, and I understand why this is hard for you. And really, this characterized my 4 years in high school, because, as I said, I was the oldest. The school was, I don't mean to whatever, it's a different school today entirely. They have changed completely, and they went, and it's not even, I mean, it doesn't have the same name. It's a very different situation today. But in those days, it was just a isha yashar ba'in of anybody did what they wanted. So I would have my father pulling me out of English classes because they were doing Jewish book month and reading Bernard Malamud and I don't know who else, if you know, and authors that he did not approve of at all. So I wasn't part of Jewish book month. That meant I missed a few English classes. I can't say I was too sad about that at that time. He pulled me out of what was called JH class, Jewish history, because the book was written by a secular Jew. And he was just once picked it up. Just it was on the table. I probably had an assignment. He picked it up. The title of the chapter that he looked at was "The Talmud as a Literary Achievement," and that's all my father needed. The Talmud as a literary achievement. He was so horrified. He called the principal. There was a principal by then. He called the principal and said, "I'm so sorry, Rabbi So and So. My daughter cannot be learning from this book. What would you like her to do?" And the principal said, "Well, I guess she's out of Jewish history class." So I was out of that class. You know, I can't say I was too sad. I had this free period, that free period, this whatever it was. Just I wanted just to bring you to the culmination of my 4 years in high school. In those days, the school graduated together with the co-ed school. So it was like one stage, one big happy family, boys, girls, all on the same stage because it's one school after all. So my father says to me, "What's with graduation?" And I said, "Well, I'm just not going." I mean, by then I was just not going. Why discuss this? I'm not going. And true enough, I was not going. Out of my class of the 10 of us, there were 10 of us, out of the class of 10 of us, 5 of us didn't go to graduation. Because again, it was, "Oh, so what are you doing about your daughter?" And again, it was, "My daughter's not going." And so 5 girls did not go to graduation. The following year, I have a sister a year younger than me. The following year, the school decided to have a separate graduation because they knew what would happen. They knew that, oh, another daughter, this is going to happen again. We might as well cut our losses right here. And from then on, the school graduated separately. But I have to say, so can you imagine the out of town I was living? Okay, very, very out of town. And very much a standard of chinuch that my parents, my father, yes, very much was the one who always was calling the principal to get me out of the classes if I needed to get out of them. But my mother, alas shalom, who was such a vibrant, alive, with it kind of person, a person, my mother grew up, was actually born in Lithuania, came over on the last boat that came out of Lithuania before the war broke out, and grew up in Detroit, Michigan, went to public school, and then went on to Revson Kaplan's Beis Yaakov, which was such an anomaly in her days. Nobody did that. She was known as the only, everybody knew her, because Debbie Levine from Detroit, who came from Detroit, Michigan, to Revson Kaplan's Beis Yaakov. So this is my mother, but full of life. She was so alive, and she made things so much. Just our house was such a happy, happening kind of a place. And this is what my parents had to deal with in my 4 years of high school. And then my sisters along the way, I kind of blazed the trail for them. So they knew what was coming already, and it was kind of a little bit easier for them somewhere there. But when I think about it, I think of how what my parents did for me, and I think this is so important for us to understand as parents, is that there needs to be a standard for your family and for what you want for your children and what the core values, nashkafos, that you want to give over to your children and that you really work at and you really explain. But there has to be along with that. It's not this is what we do because Abba says so. Our Ima says this is the way we do it. And that's what, if an Ima says this, then this is what we do. I'm not saying that can never work, but in today's day and age, that doesn't work so well. It really doesn't. And even in that day and age, way long ago when I was in high school, I saw how my parents felt. Like, you need to understand this. We need to sit down. We need to talk. We need to understand. And we need to, and that doesn't mean that the ninth grader or the seventh grader or whatever age your child is going to agree with everything you say and everything you want. But as I said this morning, the Pasuk in Mishnah tells the Shema B'nei Musar Avicha Ve'al Titosh Toras Imecha, where Shlomo HaMelech is saying there has to be a Musar Avicha and there has to be a Toras Imecha. And the Mitzuda says, I'm sorry, the Rabbeinu Yonah says over there, why? Why is this so important? That at the very outset of Mishlei, Shlomo HaMelech establishes, Shema B'nei Musar Avicha Ve'al Titosh Toras Imecha, he says, because Hana'ar Lo Shomu Klei Siklo, a child does not have their sense of reasoning, their sense of yashus, their sense of logic completely developed. It is not yet developed. And therefore, they cannot differentiate right from wrong, good from bad, standards from whatever. I want it, I need it, I must have it. That is how a child operates to a great extent. Because Yetzer Lev Adam Ra Min Urav, the Rabbeinu Yonah says, a child is born this way, a child is born wanting what he wants and needing what he needs. And together, combine that with Anar Lo Shomu Klei Siklo, and I brought down an ad from State Farm Insurance that says, why do 16-year-olds drive like they're missing part of their brains? And the answer is because they are. And I picked this up in my 11th grade class. How many of you are 16 years old? And they all raise their hands. And I'm like, what do you say about this? Why do 16-year-olds drive like they're missing part of their brain? I'm like, and all I have to do is show them it's from State Farm and it's not from Cranesville Manas, and we're okay. You know, they're like, now you know why insurance charges your parents more when you start to drive, because they write down over there that you are missing, the 16-year-olds are missing their prefrontal, dorsal, lateral cortex, which is the part of the brain that is in charge of reasoning, logic, and consequences, and therefore the teenagers are not yet equipped to figure everything out for themselves. And obviously, Shlomo HaMelech, who said this millennia before State Farm came along with their cute gimmick of an ad, obviously Shlomo HaMelech is trying to give us a very important message, and that is that we as parents need to be there and set up the infrastructure of a home, and we need to set up the guidelines that we will give over to these children, and they need to know that it's real and that we care deeply, we love them beyond, and they might not raise me here, you know, I love you and that's why I'm doing this for you. Well, thank you, Ma, I just want that cell phone, so forget about how much you love me. A mother called me recently, someone from out of Chicago, and she called me recently to ask me what I thought about getting her daughter a cell phone. And, you know, she was had very mixed feelings about the cell phone and the texting and the whole deal. Oh, no, I'm sorry. She had gotten her daughter's cell phone. She called me about texting. And she herself felt very, very strongly about texting, and she did not want her daughter to have texting, and she felt it was whatever the story was. And I said, so what happened when you had a conversation with your daughter? And she repeats the conversation to me, and she says, and I told her, I really know how much you want that texting. And her daughter says, Ma, that is not what I want to hear from you, right? Okay. It's not what I want to hear from you. Don't give me this empathy business, you know? Like, don't tell me how much you understand me, and you care about me, and you love me. Her daughter, you know, had cut through to the core of it and said, that's not what I want to hear. I just want the texting, right? And you see, that would be an example of where the mother had a certain standard that she felt was very important for her daughter, for her family, and yet she was struggling because, what am I doing? Is this going to be too? Am I holding the reins in too tight for my daughter? Am I holding them so tight that she's going to pull back and pull away? Or is it something that my daughter, and obviously for every family and for every daughter or for every son for that matter, you've got to know your own child to answer that question. So we talked a lot about what's your daughter like and do you trust her? How do you show that your daughter that you trust her? What does that mean? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Until we, you know, came to some, kind of until she came to some conclusion. I couldn't come to the conclusion for her. I just discussed it with her. But it was just the idea that, yes, it is, and I deeply care about you, and even though you may be telling me you don't want to hear that and you don't care about that, I do believe that that does come through to a child, and a child does care about that, and a child does feel when the parent is doing it, not just because I said so, but really coming from deep within where the parent can give that over to a child in the right way. So, but this is also, as I said, with every family and with every set of family dynamics, your relationship with your husband, your relationship with your children, all of that is going to come into play when you think about what is the chinuch message that I am going to give over to my child out of town. where this person's doing this and that family's doing that and that family's doing the other thing. I just want to bring out an example from a family in Chicago that I am really amazed by. And this family is a family of a very Hasidish family. Some of you may have heard the Weizener Rav. So his daughter, Feige, Rebsen Feige Unger, that, and her husband's the head of the Weizener Cheder in Chicago. The Weizener Rav, who came out of Auschwitz and Treblinka and who knows wherever else, was a Satmar Rav below Tokev, in with all of what that meant. And he came to Chicago right after the war, and he established this Kehillah for himself. There are very few Hasidim in Chicago, or I should say there were very few. We are now going to be starting our second Hasidic Shkol in the city. That is starting after Sukkot. The first one's been there for about 2 years already, and now we're coming out to the second one. So Chicago's turning into a whole new city. Talk about not being out of town. But in any case, when the Weizener Rav was there, there were very, very few Hasidim. You could count the Shraim Lach on one hand for sure. This Rebbetzin Feige Unger has had many daughters that have gone through my school, and I cannot tell you how amazed I am by this woman and how she raises her children. Because, and I'll tell you what brings it out very, very starkly. She makes her weddings in Chicago, unlike everyone else who somehow flees to Lakewood, or many people who flee to Lakewood for their weddings. But she makes her weddings in Chicago, and boy, is it an event. Boy, you could just imagine. They're Revish Einakluff, and they only marry into Revish Einakluff. So you should see what comes pouring into Chicago. From Bubba, and from Satmar, from I don't know where, and Seagate, and this, and thus, and yet. And all her siblings and siblings-in-law are all Rebbas and you just could imagine what, I can't explain to you what goes on here. Anyways, her daughters do not wear white wedding gowns. They wear light pink because the Weizener Rav, and he's one of the only people I ever heard of that believe this, held it was Kukas Hagayim. He did not believe that his children should wear white wedding gowns. So all of his grandchildren wear light pink wedding gowns, which they have made up special. The gowns are beyond magnificent. They're like, I don't know, just magnificent. And then they also, after the chuppah, they cover their hair, because this Rebbetzin Unger covers her hair with a spitzel. Not a spitzel, I don't know what it's called. I don't know the lingo for it. It's like a, she covers her hair with a turban and then like a piece of something that's supposed to look like hair. So her daughters wear, also they don't wear shetels, not even spitzels, hats on top of shetels. They wear the real thing, the turbans, okay? So for the chuppah, they wear their hair, and for after the chuppah, they come out in a turban tiara that is breathtaking, breathtaking. She makes sure that every one of her children looks like a princess. At the wedding, you can't take your eyes off of her daughters because they are so magnificently beautiful. And the way they, you should see these Hasidic women who come and dance. I don't know if you've ever seen like a real Hasidic wedding, the Satmar and the Balavrit, the women who dance. They're all beautiful, by the way. No makeup, you know, they don't wear makeup, so maybe that's why they're so beautiful. No makeup and covered hair with, I don't know what, all different kinds of headgear that they wear. Beautiful, they dress very classy and very beautifully, and they dance like, just so, like they know how to, you know. I come back from her weddings, and I go into my class the next day, and I say, girls, we must talk about what just happened last night. And you know why I want to talk to them about it? Not because I want them to become Hasidish. Sorry to tell you, I am not ready to become Hasidish, or recommend that anyone else become Hasidish, even though it's a beautiful way of life. But it's not mine. I once had a student who came to me, she was from a single parent's home. There was no real Mesorah in her family, and she told me that she wanted to marry someone Hasidish and shave her head, and that was the firmest you could get. That's what she told me. We had a little discussion about that once. She did not marry a Hasidish man, did not shave her head. But anyways, I'm saying, why do I want to discuss this with my class? Because I want to tell them, look how a person can be a family, can be their own people, and do things on their own standard. No apologies, no embarrassment. They are not embarrassed. But that's like the wedding kind of highlights it. But what I want to bring out is also that her daughters who wear seamed stockings to school, okay, seamed stockings. Otherwise they dress pretty much the way, well, some of you from Chicago could testify to what the Unger children look like. Do they look beautiful? And what else? They are so part of the crowd, the in crowd, the chavra. They are not looked at as, oh, those nebs, those frummy. Not at all. They're the GO presidents. They're the head of this committee and that committee and the other committee. They make everybody feel like $1 million. Everybody wants to be friends with them. They are, and if you stop for a minute and think about that, that's so strange, isn't it? That a girl could come to high school wearing seamed stockings and not be looked at as an oddity in the city of Chicago? Come on. I don't think there are any other families that wear seamed stockings in Chicago, are there? I don't think so. I don't think there's another family that does that, let alone come to high school wearing that, right? But there is such a feeling of, now again, I am not trying to advocate a Hasidic way of life here. That is not my point. I hope my point is being taken the way it's being offered. My point is that somebody can stand up for who they are and be proud of who they are and give that over without being judgmental, holier than thou. They are so not holier than thou. They are so not judgmental. It's all about me as a regular girl in high school, and let's just have the give and take that you and I do in regular friendships, and they have regular friendships with all different types of girls in the school, from the most right-wing, quote-unquote, whatever you want to call it, yeshivish, to the more with it modern girl in the school. They're all friends, and they know, and they do that. So what I'm thinking here, what I think we have to understand is, there is a way to do it. Is it easy? I'm not saying that. Is it just, oh sure, snap your fingers and I'll just tell my children we're going to have pride in who we are and we're great and we are wonderful. And of course that means don't look at anybody else as if they're not great and wonderful, because they're all great and wonderful too. But understand that we have to have a standard that, you know. And to some kids, it's understandable when you speak to little kids, and sometimes we've had situations, you know, in school they can get a little sticky where you'll have a kid, let's say there's a discussion that comes up about a controversial topic, a heated topic like Chol of Yisrael, okay, and then you're getting, oh gosh, well this one and that one and that one and this one, and you have little kids will go around saying, well, my family says, you know, sometimes just because they're little and kids see things as black and white, they don't understand. If we eat it, and this is the standard our family uses, well, then it's fine. And if we don't eat it, it's really not okay for anybody. They can't differentiate between a standard that their family has, thank you so much, a standard that their family has, and a standard that maybe another family does not have, but that's perfectly okay for that family, and I cannot look down at that child for that, right? So it really is up to us as parents to give that over to our children in a way that makes them understand that we want to be so proud of who we are without holding our heads up higher than everybody else and making everybody else feel like they're not worth anything. That would be absolutely, and I think that is some of the challenge that we face in out-of-town communities in giving over chinuch to our children. Like, what are we supposed to do with that? And how do we give it over in the right way? We've got to choose the words right, and we've got to, and again, you have to speak to children at an age-appropriate level, which applies all across the board in any conversation you're having with a child, because there's a different way to talk to an 8-year-old about something like that and to a 15-year-old about something like that, or any such topic, and giving over with the pride, with the, this is who we are, we want to have a standard like this, but at the same time, if we understand it. And one of the issues that I think we deal with a lot in out-of-town communities is there's a wide spectrum of friends, and we're all concerned. Everybody knows, rightfully so, we all should be concerned with who our children's friends are, because, let's face it, we might be great parents and really work hard at parenting our children, and then comes along one little girl, and she, like, kind of turns her nose up at something, and she's my daughter's good friend, and guess what? Her words pack a punch a lot more than mine do, and what am I supposed to do about that one? I actually remember that from my high school days, because my mother, Alashon, really did not like one of my friends, really did not. And guess what? She was right. She didn't know how right she was. I can tell you now how right my mother was. She just sensed that this was not an okay friendship for me. She was not happy with this girl. She was really intense, and she was really, she did not like her. And of course, the more she said that to me, what happened? The more I dug my heels in, and she's my best friend, and blah, blah, blah. You know, we were just inseparable, and my mother did not approve of that so much, and I knew that, and I struggled with it in high school. But so what are we supposed to do about that? What if there are, like, this wide spectrum of friends, and sometimes it's a friend who may be from a different background or may have different values than you, or maybe she comes from a wonderful background and wonderful family of values, but she somehow is not bringing out the best in your daughter. And that would be an issue anywhere, obviously. That would be an issue in town, out of town, wherever you want to say it, right? But I think as we grapple with that, we really have to figure out a way to, it doesn't work. And everybody here knows that, either from your own experiences with friends or as mothers of children. You cannot try to separate your child from a friend and just say, that's it, you will have nothing to do with this friend, she is not coming into our house again, absolutely not, unless there's something really inappropriate going on. In that case, of course you can do that. But other than that, you cannot really do that. It will not work. So I think part of it is that you want your child, and this is nothing new, you've all heard it so many times, I'm sure, you want your child to bring their friends to your house. You want to be the center of activity. And you're thinking to yourself, what in the world is she saying? I so don't want to be the center of activity. Let them go somewhere else Shabbos afternoon. I don't need my house full of a bunch of little kids this age, that age. Sometimes you feel like you're running a three-ring circus. You know, the 7-year-olds are in this part of the house, and the 10-year-olds are over here, and the 14-year-olds are over there, and then they're all, and then the 14-year-old comes in, Ma, he's so annoying, tell him to get his friends out of here. And then you're like, okay, now what do I do? Okay, so, but really you do want your children to come and bring their friends to your home, and you want to be able to interact with those friends, and you want to be able to kind of see what's going on. And then obviously if you need to give your child, and you need to try to make your child see certain things when you've heard certain words come out of her friend's mouth, or just a very rude way of talking, or very inappropriate way of talking, you can use an example with your child and say, I need you to understand that when Shiffy talks like that, somehow it's rubbing off on you, and I need to understand, da 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 da, whatever it is, right? And I'm not saying, some teenagers or some children will be willing to accept it, some just will not, and they'll just blow you off. Ma, you don't understand, she's so not like that. Somehow when she comes to our house, yeah, right, somehow when she comes to our house, somehow it just, you know, happens that way, right? So I think that if we can just try to bring things together and bring it to our home becomes the home base for our children, and they want to be home. They feel good about being home, right? And I talked this morning about making our homes into just a place of happiness and happening. Things are happening in my home. I'm going to be thinking of activities, not just, hey, you're bored, just figure out what you want to do. Go find something to do. Now, obviously, we do have to tell our children that sometimes, not in that tone of voice, I hope, but sometimes we do have to tell our children, you know, Mommy's busy now, or Ema can't right now, or whatever the case is, and go read something, and maybe in an hour I'll be able to go on, I'll be able to take you wherever it is, whatever it is, right? We'll go for Slurpees, that's the big activity, right? What could be better? In Chicago now, they open, believe it or not, a cafe in a gas station. If anybody comes to Chicago, now you know we're really not out of town, because a cafe, call yourself cafe in a gas station. So a la Lakewood, here we come, and that is the hot spot. You tell your teenage daughter that you're taking her to the Lincoln Cafe, you have scored points. On Lincoln, in the BP gas station, on Lincoln, right past Vermont. Mm-hmm. So please, by all means, you're coming to Chicago, you must go. I must say that my claim to fame is I have not been there yet, okay? So, but a lot of my students have, and I've heard a lot about the Lincoln Cafe, so yeah, you score a lot of points if you just take your daughter to Lincoln Cafe. It doesn't have to be this big outing. You're just showing your daughter, I care about you, let's go, let's have a good time, here's a treat, here's that, whatever it is. But in any case, you, as a mother, we, as mothers, have to create happenings for our children. Because if we don't want them doing this, that, and the other thing, and we don't, right? And there is so much out there. But we can't just keep saying, no, 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 no this, no that, no the other thing. We can't. That is not an answer to anything. We have to be able to say, yes, 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 let's make something happen. Let's have something happen here. Girl, get your friends and let's get out. Blah, 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 whatever it is. And sometimes the mother has to become a very creative person. And some mothers will say to me, I'm not creative. Just because you could think of these kind of things, I only could do it because once you're in high school, as long as I've been, and I never get to leave high school, once you're in high school, as long as I've been, your mind just, okay, what can I do for these high school girls? What more could we do? What else could we do? What other things? You just kind of think like that. But I didn't used to be creative either, so there's hope for people, you know, who say, I'm not creative, I can't think of things to do, I don't know, what do you want me to do with my kids, it's fine, whatever it is. And it's just, you just see people who just, we're not talking about spending a lot of money, we're not talking about going to, I don't know, there's this new place in Chicago that they do bungee jumping, $100 a shot. I'm like, okay. But unfortunately, today some parents just want to, like, buy off their children. Who take your child bungee jumping for $100? What are we talking? I mean, I'm sorry. To me, that's appalling. It really is, I must say. So it is pretty appalling to me. So, but we're not talking about spending a lot of money. We're not talking about, you know, needing to do these exotic things, even though for kids, the stakes keep getting higher and higher. And we kind of feed into that, and the schools feed into that, camps feed into that big time. I have this big thing about camps. I don't know how many of your kids go to overnight camp, but oh well, that's what they do. When they come back, they have a great time, but they really raise the stakes quite a bit. You know, I'm like, always when they come back from camp and we start school 2 days later, I'm always like, oh no, we're in for it now. Like glassy-eyed, they walk in like after having had every treat imaginable for 30 days running, and then they come to school and have to sit in desks. That's a lot of fun, right? You know, a lot of fun. But in any case, so another thing I want to point out, I mentioned that this morning as well, is that we cannot be afraid of our children. And children sense that very quickly. And there are parents who really are running scared. They're running scared of their children. They're afraid of their children. And I can't say I don't understand why. I do understand why. There's so much out there that they're like, no, but if I say no to her about this, then who knows what's going to happen? Who knows? And they're already imagining, she's this and she's that, and they're 5 years down the line imagining that, who knows, the worst is happening, right? God forbid. So I understand why, but being scared of our children is not the answer. We need to do this in a way where, again, it's about understanding the child, showing a tremendous amount of love to the child, showing a tremendous amount of positivity to the child, and then being able to sit down and have an honest, decent, open conversation about whatever it is and figure this out and figure out how this is going to work. And what we have to understand also is that every community has its own unique challenges. I am sure that the challenges we face in Chicago, where there are different things going on than there are here, the challenges they face in Lakewood, New Jersey are quite a few. The challenges that there are in Flatbush and challenges in, you know, every place faces its own challenges. I was recently up in the Catskill Mountains where my daughter was the principal, she's moving now, but she was the principal of a high school in South Fallsburg. Now, South Fallsburg, for any of you who know what it is this tiny little yeshiva community, about 75, 80 families. I describe it as the last cave left in America. That's where it is. What Lakewood used to be 30 years ago is what South Fallsburg is today, the last cave in America. And it really is so isolated and so up there in the mountains and so unexposed, relatively speaking, of course. And when I went up there and I talked to the high school girls there, and I did a lot of one-on-one with high school girls there, I saw that they had their own unique challenges. I mean, I kind of knew that, but I heard it loud and clear. They had their own unique challenges, and they're as in town as it comes, right? And their challenges were different than what your children's challenges would be. So every community's got their own challenges, their own chinuch challenges, their own parenting challenges. And as parents and as people who believe deeply in chinuch and want that chinuch to really, really bear fruit with their children, we need to look at where we are and figure out what are our challenges, what is my family's challenges, and what am I going to do to work this out and to deal with it. And you know what? It's very easy to throw the blame on someone else. Well, if the, you know, school would be this, and if the teachers would be this, and I'm not saying. I said this morning, in response to some questions that I got, that as a teacher and as a principal, I know that the responsibility is humongously great, and it rests on my shoulders, and I know that quite well. And I daven for Siyat Nishmaya, and we ask for help from HaKadosh Baruch Hu on every step that we take. But and the schools and the teachers need to know that they really have an enormous responsibility. But at the same time, parents cannot abdicate their role as parents and give that over to the school. That doesn't work either. Right? And say, well, if the school would only this, that, and the other thing, well, what about you? What are you doing as the parents for this child, right? So obviously the best case scenario is when the school and the parents work together and are a team. That's best case scenario. That's not always possible in every community, depending on what every situation is. Again, every school is different, every city is different, every community is different. But what we need to understand is that we, who take our chinuch of our children very, very seriously and who daven and really, really hope and wait that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should just help us be the right kind of parents for these children, for the children that are those special neshamos entrusted to us, special, special ones, who are our children, right? And looking at someone else's children, looking at someone else's family, doesn't help anybody either. It really doesn't, right? Doesn't at all. I want to just, you know, conclude and then open up to some questions where we see that in Eishes Chayil it says, Sofia halichos besa, v'lechem atzos lo sochel. Sofia halichos besa. The Eishes Chayil looks at the ways of the members of our household. Sofia. Sofia is a lashon of sofeh. To look far into the future. And to see, remember in Navi when you would have learned that the sofeh stood at the top of the tower and he looked to see if there was an approaching enemy. He looked far out into the distance. And he was the one who was on guard to see if there was an approaching enemy. So Sophia is that the mother looks into the far distance to see what is my child doing and how is this going to impact on them. And she responds accordingly. It isn't a knee-jerk reaction to everything the child wants, everything the child's doing, and it's no, 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 and I'm not going to let you. Right? It's how is this going to affect my child in the future? What ramifications will this have for my child in the future? And as such, You have to be able to differentiate. There are some things I will not let my children do because I know that the ramifications for the future are not going to be very positive ones. And then there are other things where I might say to my child, you know what, I trust you. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the pros and cons. I trust you. And let's see if, you know, what your choice is. There are times when I will open up a choice. I did this with my children, and I do it now with my students. And I always try to, you know, you're davening because you know what choice you want them to make, don't you? Right? So, of course, all the parenting experts tell you you can only offer choices when you are okay with both choices. You've heard that, haven't you? That's the only time you can offer choices. But I beg to differ a little bit. You have to offer a choice where either choice is acceptable to you. Obviously, sometimes one is preferred. But if you talk to them, you talk about the pros and cons, and you give that over to the child, and you know that you're not offering them something. It's not like I'm offering my child a choice of whether they want to go to a rock concert. Well, honey, I want you to understand a rock concert's not the best place to be, but on the other hand, you'll hear some music. No, no, no. This is not what choice you're offering your child, because you know that the long-term effects of a rock concert are not going to be a good one on that precious little neshama of yours, and you know that quite well. On the other hand, there are other things where you might have to, and that's where you're dealing and you're thinking, and how am I going to do this? And again, the trust in my child is so important. And conveying that trust to a child, on the other hand, you have to be able to trust that child. You can't just say, oh, I want to trust you, and of course they have trust. And then you hear those same parents say, well, I trusted my child, and look what she did. She betrayed my trust, and now it's nothing. She's got me home by 7 o'clock every night, and she's not going to do this, and she's not going to do that. I'm like, okay, so here you went all the way this way. Now you're yanking her back all the way that way. That makes a lot of sense, you know. So, we have to look into how is this going to affect my child? What are the long-term ramifications of this particular action or choice or decision that I'm making, that my child's making, and that hopefully with a tremendous, tremendous siyata d'shmaya, amount of siyata d'shmaya that each and every parent needs for each and every child, right? And we all know that the tefillos that we offer for each and every child, and the tears that we let drop for each and every child, right? And we want so badly to make our homes, and that's what we need to do, to make our homes into a fortress of Kedusha, to make our homes into a place where what I am, what my husband is, what we want, what we try to portray to our children, what we model for our children, the way we give it over to our children is that of Kedusha, and then Amir Hashem, that should bear fruit, and Amir Hashem, everybody should see tremendous nachas from their children. And so I would like to open this up to questions, because I would welcome any questions that you might have here. I'm not sure if I kept within my 5 minutes, but whatever.
I wanted to say that. So you mentioned a family in Chicago that was the family that was in Chicago. And so I wanted to get any practical examples. So how do you tell your kids you are, you know, let's say, the school, let's say, for example, with the movie, right? The child tells you, you know, your whole class is going to be, you're not going to the movie theater. But how do you tell yourself that the same thing, but don't consider yourself aloof, that you are not better than everybody else?
It's a really tough one. It's a really, really tough one. I think your children have to see that you interact respectfully with other members of the community, and that's just a piece, but in other words, that your interactions, you go out of your way to welcome somebody, to say hello to somebody, to greet somebody, to, you know, to be so nice and forthcoming and sensitive to people, and you're not just kind of holding yourself, like, if she's my type, if she's not my type, and I think that here in a community like this, everybody does that, because I sense that that is really very much the hanhaga of the people in this community, that everybody's out there welcoming everybody else and showing that they can interact with other people and really, you know, caring about other people. So if a child senses that it's not like, you know, this distance like this, we have nothing to do with these people and, you know, we're just doing what we want and our family is better than everybody else, and it's just the tone of voice that you use with children, the way you explain to them that this is something that we feel, we want this, this is so important for us, and Tati and I thought about this and we discussed it, and this is so important because we feel this is going to, it's hard, because it's hard to say, what words are you going to use? You don't want to sound like you're preaching. Some children will accept that. For some children to say to them that this is going to be something that's special for you as a Bas Yisrael, some children will take that, and some people will like, okay, Ma, okay, enough, like, okay, I don't really need to hear that, you know. So, you know, you have to know your child, and you have to be willing to give them other fun activities and say, you know what, I want you to have a good time, and we're going to go out as a family, and we're going to do this, that, and the other thing, or whatever it is, and it may cost you money to do that, And it may be something where you're trying to show, and again, but if your children, but you have to really come across to them as, you know, but this is not, but I want you to understand that if another family is doing this, that is okay for that family. And we're not in a position to decide what other families should do or shouldn't do, because if they ask their Rav and if they're doing what their family is supposed to do, that's not for us to decide. And you can, right? So, but I think more than the actual words we use, is the whole attitude we give over. Do you hear what I'm saying? Just how it comes across and how our children, again, see us. Are we just friendly, happy people, happy to interact with people, happy to, you know, and it doesn't mean you have to, you know, invite every single family along to go with you on your family activities. It doesn't mean that. You can create, you know, and it's an important thing to create just family time and family fun. And again, I said this morning, some of you are hearing a lot of things twice, I'm so sorry. But I just feel like we, the mothers, have to be the ones to create that vibrancy, that excitement in the home. It's got to be there. It's got to come from us, right? So when we do that, it's just, you know, other than, I don't know, I'm trying to think of, like, what exact words you could use, but there's no script. And I think everybody has to deal with it in their own family with the way they do. But just, it has to be given over. It's so important that it's given over and right. It is so important because, you know. And I was friends with those girls who were Christian Kippot, you know, I was. And I can't say we were best friends, and those were probably some of them my mother didn't like either, but, you know, we were friends. I didn't, you know. And it was, but we also knew that, yes, we did, you know, and in those days, my father's in Tel Yeshiva. Tel Yeshiva was, you were at Tel Yeshiva, you were like looked down at. We were looked down at. I was looked down at. I felt that, I actively felt that people looked down at me because I was at Tel Yeshiva, quote unquote. It was really nebby to be at Tel Yeshiva. You were like really, really, you did not rate. I really felt that way. It was true in those days. You did not rate. The rating has changed somewhat. It doesn't, that's not the way it looks in the city at all right now, but that's what it was in those days. And I knew that this is, you know, that we had a certain standard. This was my family. I had a certain standard. And I have to say, you heard, I resisted it a little bit. I wasn't, you know, but I have to tell you something interesting. And this is such an interesting example. My sister, my youngest sister, the one I talked about this morning, but in a very different context right now, and she was a senior. So we had, by the way, you know who were my Chumash teachers? Shlichim from Bnei Akiva. Shlichim from Bnei Akiva would be sent to Chicago to do their shlichut in Chicago, and those were my Chumash teachers. Kippah Sruga and all perched on top of bushy head of hair were my Chumash teachers. My Yirmiyahu teacher did not cover her hair. Okay? She did not cover her hair. And she was an actress in the Yiddish theater. And she would go, Shimu Melachim, Azino Roshim. Okay. So you understand, my father and mother had their work cut out for them here, but so when my sister, I didn't really pay too much attention, I must say, shamefully so, to my Shluchim from Bnei Akiva, they didn't really read on my radar screen too much. But my sister, when she was in 12th grade, she had a Shliach of Bnei Akiva, who was tall, dark, and handsome. That did not hurt at all. And very brilliant. And he had the class eating out of the palm of his hand. And every girl in the class loved him. Okay? And here's Rav, whatever his name is. Let's call him Rav Schwartz. Okay? And comes Yom HaAtzmaut, and he walks into the class, and he says, I brought a special promo for Yom HaAtzmaut. And I don't know which one he fought in. He was a chayal in the army. And this means so much to him. It's so special for him that he's able to share with them Yom HaAtzmaut. And my sister's sitting there looking a little uncomfortable. And this Fagi Unger was in her class. Fagi Mize was in her class, also looking a little uncomfortable. And Chani Murek, Mrs. Murek. So the three of them are like getting a little hot under the collar here. And he puts on the technique and music fills the room. So my sister and her two friends get up and try to kind of edge out of the room. They're edging out of the room by themselves because they don't want to make a big deal about this, but they're not allowed to listen to music during Sfira, and Yom HaAtzmaut is during Sfira, and they're not listening to music, and finish, end of the story. Rav Schwartz stops them in their tracks, banot. And he says, why are you leaving? And they say, we're not allowed to listen to music on during Sfira. And he says, with tears in his eyes, girls, if you leave, I will have to stop the tachnit. You are part of my class, and if you leave, I will not put on the tachnit for anybody in our class. He says, I will teach chumash. And he says, with tears in his eyes, "This is very meaningful to me, and I want you to stay." Now, put a high school senior, she was young because she skipped my sister, she was 16 and a half years old, put a high school senior into that position, and what would you do? And my sister stood up and said, "I'm so sorry, Rav Schwartz, I need to leave. And please continue, I will be happy for you to continue with your tachlit, but I need to leave." And he said, "No, I will not, but I'm tachlit," turned it off, and saw chumash, okay? That's scene one. Let's go fast forward to the school's, whatever, they had a retreat of some sort. And Rav Schwartz comes with his cute little wife and his adorable little children, and he comes to this retreat, and he calls over my sister in front of everybody. He says, "Sarah, boyena, I want to know from you why you wouldn't listen to my tachnit on your matzvot," in front of the entire class and probably the rest of the school too. And she had to defend what she did in front of everybody there, and everybody's like, she said her classmates were like shooting daggers at her. Could you imagine? They were like shooting daggers at her. It was bad enough that you didn't let us listen to this tachnit, and now you're going to. And she had to. She felt like he asked her. He wanted an answer. So she did. She explained what my father had put into us every year before Yom HaTzimut. My father would sit us down and talk about Yom HaTzimut and talk about how we love Eretz Yisrael and we have a tremendous chavivus for Eretz Yisrael, but the Medinat Yisrael and Yom HaTzimut is not about the Hatzchalat HaGeula that they think it is and whatever it is, blah, 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 whatever it is. So I'm saying it was just such a, like it was just so, there was a strength that was put into us of knowing who we were, what we stood for, and knowing how to use it, not to abuse it, right? It was not like, "I'm going to show it to you in your face," but if you needed to, you were going to do that, you know? So I don't know that I have the answer. I don't know that your challenges are the same as those. I don't know that anybody who fought in the Melchemet HaShechrur, it wasn't HaShechrur, it was Melchemet Yom HaTzimut probably, Yom Kippurim or whatever, but I don't know if that answered your question at all. I wish I had a script. I don't have the script. But any other questions that we can? Yes.
Maybe tell me if this is right or not, or how to, you know, understand it. But let's say a 15-year-old boy or girl, okay? They know a whole lot more about the internet, and they know how to take apart the computer and put it back together.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I think it's smarter for me to tell my child, you know, you really do have a lot. You know, you're really very capable of being able to get, you know, understand how to use the internet. And you really could get to a lot of information that we wouldn't want you to have.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to tell you that I'm going to trust you. You know, at some point, when I realized that they really have the ability to keep secrets, and I'd rather they didn't, I'd rather take the stance of giving them permission to go for it, even though I know they get around K-9 and everything else. I've heard about that. How do you see
that? Oh boy, that is a loaded question, because that's a very, it's all very nice to say you trust your child, but what everybody tells us, and what you said you've heard yourself, kids know how to get around anything. They are far more savvy than we are, even though you are younger than me, so you're more savvy than I am, I suppose. But, you know, they really, really, I mean, and why are we talking about children? Why aren't we talking about adults who are using technology? Can you trust adults who are using technology without a filter? Can you trust adults who are, and this is not me saying this, obviously these are Avigdor, Matsyo, Solomon, Zohar Gesundheit, you should have Refuah Shleima, very much so, but Ramatisho stood up and was Lochi Milchemes Hashem. He stood up and they had a whole kinnus and that whole thing, and he said, and if you've heard from the experts, I think Rav Nechemya Gottlieb was out here, wasn't he, in Denver? Was he here? Because he was by us recently, and I think he told me he was in Denver. And you hear from the experts in the field, and they are saying that, you know, there's so much we have to know about, and so you're presenting, well, my child's going to do it anyways. If that's what you're saying, I don't know about your child or many children, can do it anyways, will do it anyways, then what are we saying when we say we trust them? Are you saying, I trust you that every time you get onto an inappropriate site, you're going to come tell me? Is that what we're saying? I don't know that that's so realistic, right? I don't know that that's so realistic. Are we saying, definitely I do feel there should be an open conversation with a teenager about this, absolutely open conversation. And the teenagers cannot see that a parent has one standard for themselves and another standard for them. Okay, they can see, like, for example, what's come up with texting is a little bit of a different issue. because texting, I'll tell you that I go into my class and I say to them, so are teenagers addicted to texting? And they resoundingly say, yes. And I say to them, well, you just took away my whole lesson because I was supposed to explain to you that teenagers are really addicted, but you just said they are, so we can quit right here. You're all addicted to texting? Okay, next, you know. So in other words, teenagers will readily admit that they are addicted to texting. Obviously not every single teenager, but there is a difference between texting, adult texting, and teenagers texting. I'm not saying it's always, I'm not saying the boundaries haven't been crossed. I'm not saying there haven't been adults who have been inappropriate in texting. We all know what the issues are with texting. But if a parent is texting, informational texting, etc., like that's what they're, it's very different than giving their teenager unlimited texting and letting them text whoever, whatever, and their whole, their, all their interactions with their friends become about texting, right? But when you're talking about actually going online to wherever, whatever it is, and having that phone without a filter, without anything, I think children see a little bit of hypocrisy in their parents. Like, why is my parents allowed, why is it okay for my parent when what came out from the Gedolim was not that teenagers should have filters on their smartphones? It was that all Erlocha from, you know, the person with Yerusha Shamayim has to know that this is an issue. And what do we need, what do we need to know more? I mean, why do we need to know the stories? You've all heard, I suppose, the stories. I hear the stories. And it's very, very painful to me and very sad to me when I get a call from one of my students who's crying on the phone because her husband is XYZ, right? And what am I supposed to do about that, she wants to know. Like, this isn't what I signed up for. I thought I was marrying a wonderful Ben Torah. And somehow, right, and I heard a story from a Mechanechet of a seminary who said that one of her students called her and said, you know, she works on the internet, so she has internet at home. And she loves being able to do all the shopping and all that, whatever it is. But she noticed lately that her husband seems to have, I don't know what, gotten the password, knows the password, got on, did, whatever. She noticed lately that maybe her husband is, you know, involved over here. And she said, so her Mechanecha said to her, okay, so what are your options? You know, she works online, what's she supposed to do? So she said, well, is an office for rent down the street? I could really rent office space, I could put the computer there, I could do that. And they talked about it, and she said, great idea, that's what you need to be doing, blah, blah, blah. And then the girl says to her, but you know what, when it's 12 o'clock at night and I'm in my PJs and I'm so comfortable and I feel like ordering a pair of shoes from Nordstrom, I'm not going to go down the block to order the shoes. I can't do that. And her teacher said to her, okay, so here we're talking about your comfy pajamas and shoes from Nordstrom and your husband, Yerusha Shamayim. That's a great equivalent. I love that. You know, I don't know what her student decided to do. I have no idea. I can only tell you that the stories that I have heard, and I certainly am not the cross-country reference for internet situations, but I've heard my share enough to tell me that I know, right? So that, what is that? What's the question here? To trust the child. If you're saying they know how to get around K-9, if you're saying you know that they can do anything that, you know, whatever, I don't know. So trust them with a loaded gun? I don't know. Trust them that they know how to shoot? Trust them? What do we trust? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, it's not good. I don't feel that that's a good enough answer. Because the fact of the matter is, if they haven't, is that they haven't, they have the ability to do something. And if I tell them no, in today's day,
okay, and if you tell them yes. Okay, and if you tell them yes.
If I tell them that, look, we have a conversation. And I say, look, the truth of the matter is that, what can I do? It's between you and a Kaddish Baruch Hu.
Okay.
Nobody is in life, you know? Okay, so you know how I feel about it.
Okay.
And I know that you are capable.
So what does that mean? That you're allowing the child to have his own device? No, I want to know. Does it mean you're allowing the child to have their own device? Does it mean...
It's a family computer.
Family?
It's in sight of the family.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of that is that I like to have my time at night where I can relax, and I'm not going to be watching that child on the computer. And it's, of course, it's K-9 and all that. But the fact of the matter is, I'm still worried.
Uh-huh. Okay, so...
Why do you have to have a family computer?
Because what can I do with the school?
We never had a family computer until this year when my husband said, I'm alone so many hours, maybe in 1 week.
I have it for my teenager who's a student. And what happens is that she has to do homework, and on their homework she has to come up with all kinds of designs and images. And she has to come up with what do you find on the computer that does this, that, and the other thing. And she's also told she has that little type.
Okay, but type does not have to be internet access. Type is not internet access at all, right?
It's hardly possible. It's hardly possible. It's hardly possible
to type without the internet, yeah, because typing is an easy one without the internet, right? But I'm saying, I understand that especially teenagers today make us feel like they all need internet access, don't they? I mean, they want internet access. Would there be people, some people would say, I'm just not having internet in my house. I am not having it in my house. Would there be people who would say that? Yes, there would be people who would say that. And they would say, if the reason you're having it is, I can't tell you on a personal level what to do, what not to do, but I'm just saying in general, if the reason you're having internet is for your teenager, that's scary to me. That is scary to me. Some people have to have it for their work. Some people say, well, my husband is, I don't know what, he needs it for this, that, the other thing. So you're right that trying to have a conversation, but again, telling a 15-year-old boy you're a shamayim is wonderful, and I very strongly feel that yes, but the pull towards whatever's on the internet, the mayim genuvim im taku, is so strong, right? How do we fight that by a speech about you're a shamayim?
Down with my child, I have to be on the internet, even with Kayla.
Mm-hmm.
I want to surprise.
Okay, that's wonderful. So that's wonderful.
It doesn't matter. Hey.
They could still get around you. Okay. So I guess this would be something I would think you should take up a consultation with a Rav. You should speak to Das Torah. You should ask Das Torah what to do. And again, there are different situations in every family, and you have to know. But we have to understand that to do this because it's easier for us, and we can order tickets online, and we can order shoes online, and all that kind of thing. We have to ask ourselves, what am I doing here? And what is this bringing into my family? And that's something that, again, every family with a consultation with your Rav, you should know that one of the things that the TAG office is thinking of doing or trying to start, and I thought it was such a phenomenal idea, is they want to have technology coaches. And that every family would sit down with the technology coaches, depending on if a school buys into this idea, like we were talking about it for my school. That means that any family in our school would agree to sit down with a technology coach. And the technology coach would go through with them, what are their family's technology needs? They're not saying, no, 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 you can't have anything. They're saying, what are your family's technology needs, and how are we going to be able to use this safely and responsibly? I thought that was a great idea. Isn't that a great idea? Because I want to tell you something. A lot of parents are just clueless. Do you agree with me on that? Parents are clueless. I've heard from kids what they do online. I've heard it from kids. They tell me. I can get past anything my mother thinks. My mother has no clue. She's sleeping, and I do what I want. I've heard this. Right? And I've seen the kids with their heads down in class like this and can't keep their heads up straight. I'm talking about great girls. I'm not talking about the girls who were struggling and problems and this and that. I'm thinking about one girl who was at the top of the class. A girl went, because she was whatever, however she got into, however it happened to her. These stories happen across the country. It doesn't have to tell you about what happened to my school. I can tell you any school across the country, right? And so that's why, by the way, when you talk about, it's interesting, we talk about out of town, in town. So my sister, the one I was just talking about before, is the principal of Beis Yaakov of Lakewood. And she has a school of Kanainahara, 500 some girls, Lakewood all the way, Beis Yaakov all the way. And it's so interesting to me that some of the very same challenges that I face, she's facing. When I'm talking about the long hair that our students wear, that we work very hard on, but, you know, whatever it is. And guess what? They're facing the same challenges over there. And we talk about internet, they're facing the same challenges. We talk about texting, they're facing, to some degree, Klal Yisrael is facing very big challenges, right? And every family has to really, really put that in, work really, really hard to make sure. And again, we need Siyat Tishmaya, we need Das Torah, we need Das Torah. We can't just assume that, oh, because we're all such nice, fine, firm people, if my child does this or that, it's going to be okay, right? We have to ask Das Torah, and we have to figure it out. And I am not against trusting children. I am all for trusting children, but there are so many things. Like, would you give a 16-year-old, you have to try to figure out, would I give this loaded gun to a 16-year-old and say, well, I trust you. Well, he's not trying to murder anybody. He's really not. He's just trying to fool around with it, have a good time, whatever it is. No, I don't think that's such a good idea, right? So you have to know for yourself and with Das Torah, with consultation with Das Torah. Any other questions? Yes.
But when it comes to encouraging friendships, if there's somebody who I'm not equally comfortable with this family and what they do, but I want my child to have friends,
mm-hmm.
So is it a really bad idea for me to encourage them to be friends with this child who has very good midos,
but comes from a family that
Okay. So it depends. It really depends on a lot of things. How old your child is, what kind of things they're going to be doing. Are you going to be the one who's able to supervise and monitor and control? I don't mean control your child, control the activities. As they get older, what is that going to mean? And what I'll tell girls who will come and express a concern about a certain friend who's doing things that are inappropriate, and what do I do about this friendship because she's a good friend of mine. You know, sometimes I'll get a question like that. And what I tell the girls, which is different than what I'm answering you, but what I'll tell the girls is, are you the stronger one in the friendship? Are you the leader? Are you the leader here, or is the other girl the leader? Are you able to stand up to her if you feel something inappropriate? Are you going to stand your ground, and are you going to decide that, no, let's do something else, and I'll create the fun, and I'll make it happen? Or are you going to be giving in to what your friend wants? And that would be a barometer for, is this a good, healthy friendship for you? Can you stay in this friendship, or do you perhaps need to, whatever. Now, if you're talking about a younger child, clearly the child is not yet the leader in the friendship, or not the leader, although sometimes, can't you see these little four-year-olds who are the bossy ones who boss everybody around? I've got a granddaughter like that. She can boss around the six-year-olds and gets them eating out of the palm of her hand, and she's like, you know, she's like the little geo president at 4 years old, you know, that type. So sometimes you can see it in little kids, too. Right, but often you might not be able to see it in a little child. And if you will be able to really listen, are there some people who would say, listen, I do want my children to have friends, but I'm gonna kind of see what develops. But right now, this is not for me. There would be some people who would say that, and there would be some people who would say, if I can be the one and I can invite that child to my house, and I know what's going on, and I'm supervising, and I see the child has good meadows, and their language is appropriate. It's not something that's, you know, whatever, and my child knows that there are no secrets. That's an important piece that you brought out, right? I think that's a big piece nowadays. That's been really highlighted, right, for kids, and that's great. That there are no secrets. In other words, someone says, don't tell your mother, you know, like, we're not doing that anymore. Those days are hopefully gone, right, and hopefully we'll bring much sequence to Klal Yisrael. But, so I'm saying, depending on that situation, you have to really see what you would think about that. Yes?
I am a born and bred out of towner, much more so than most people in this room. And in my vast worldly experience in my great age, I have seen in my life that there are two paradigms when it comes to living out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us have different reasons for living out of town. There's the we are out of towners mindset, which is kind of like, somewhere out there in the East, there are stores of vast Klal Yisrael Yoruba. I hear tell. But in essence, that maybe we send our kids to Canada, that maybe we go on trips there and we see the natives and like whatever, and we buy socks. But in essence, this is where we live. We live in Denver. We've all lived in Denver. Our grandparents lived in Denver. Our children live in Denver. That's not so common. But, like, this is what we do. And, you know, come, buy water, or whatever, like, we deal with it, and we roll with it, and we make it work. And then there's the paradigm that says, I need most of nefesh to live out of town, whether I'm to the cube, whether we move to this forsaken spot on the map, or Parnassa, or because my husband likes to hike, how did that happen, or whatever, like, this here.
You should have found out if you liked to hike before you married him.
And it's so hard, and everything that comes up, let's go to that town. If I lived in Lakewood, like my sister-in-law, I'd have perfect children like my sister-in-law, or like whatever. So there's these two opposing paradigms that people take, and when a challenge arises, I guess what I want to ask is, obviously I believe it's much nicer to go through life, you know, seeing what a beautiful community we live in, and physically and spiritually, etc. But when push comes to shove, which one is right when we have a challenge? Let's say we have a chinuch challenge. Like, I remember growing up, like, you know, the families would trot over the Oregon Trail and come to the West Coast and be like, we're going to dig in and start our homestead, and then something would happen. Like, they would have a child with special needs or lowly, some kind of tragedy would happen, or even not such a tragedy, like, oh, my kid is going in sixth grade, and there's only one other girl, and we don't like her parents. Something like that. So, bye. Nice to know, Alia. So I guess my question is, like, specifically to out of town, that's the topic, and I think that this is a specifically out of town issue. What is the mindset that we should take in our position living out of town, and how do we maintain kind of a positive view of our circumstances and achieve that minuchat nefesh?
Oh boy, you just asked a big, big question. It was a triple header, if I heard that correctly. It's interesting that you present those two paradigms because, interestingly, I never thought of myself in either of those two paradigms, even though like I'm as out of town as they come in terms of the way I was raised and where I was born and all the rest of it. And I never thought of myself as, oh, I just live here and this is my place in life and therefore I am, you know. I also never thought of myself as being Moser Nefesh for living in Chicago. Never. That was not a, oh my, I, you know, and oh, if only I lived elsewhere. No, so it's interesting that you paint that picture, and I think that they are very good scenarios and probably true for a lot of people. I think there's some places in between too, probably, that some of us find ourselves in. But certainly, a person, once the decision has been made, and I assume that your husband didn't just like pull you here against your will and drag you, kicking and screaming to death or to wherever else you might live. I assume that was not the case. Like I said, you should have found out if your husband like died before you moved, before you married him. But what?
I'm one like died.
Oh, you're the one. Okay, that's great. But in other words, I assume the decision was a joint decision. It was a mutual decision for people who have moved here from other parts of the country. And you came for various reasons. And yes, Parnas is involved. And yes, Kirov is involved. And yes, just wanting to make a difference in a community is involved. And boys, do people here make a difference in a community, right? So those may be some of the factors. There may be other factors as well, right? Family, different kinds of things may have happened along the way, and somehow this presented itself. I assume nobody made this decision as a 1, 2, 3. We decided today, and by next week, we're on our way to Denver. You know, I assume it was with a lot of thought, and it was with a lot of calculation, it was with a lot of preparation, it was with checking out the community, checking out the schools, checking out the shuls. I assume all of that happened before people move out to an out-of-town community. As such, I would say that once that decision has been made, you come to the community, and of course, there's transitioning, and there's just really trying to make it work, because kol haschalos kashrus, and let's face it, kol haschalos could last for a long, long time. Right? The kol haschalos, some of you may be here for 5 years and you're still in the kol haschalos kashrus period of time, you know. But so giving allowance for the transitioning, the kol haschalos kashrus, the settling in, the meeting new people, and some people do really well with change and some people do not. It takes them a lot longer to settle in. They're kind of more private people. They need their space, you know, that kind of thing. So depending on how, you know, you are as a person, but once you've come to some place, you really, really need to have a mindset that this is where we are and this is where we can fulfill Ratzon Hashem. And being that wife who's constantly fetching and complaining about it, first of all, the poor husband here, is that not true? And he's like, but I thought we made this decision together, honey. And you're like, well, I didn't know that X, Y, Z, and A, B, C, you know, if you would have told me that, you probably didn't, you know, your inference there is you probably didn't tell me on purpose because you wanted to just trick me into going to Denver or some such thing, right? But if you, the way that you're giving this over to your poor husband who's got to deal with it, and let's face it, your children are absorbing that really fine and well. And how are the children supposed to be able to feel good about where they live and feel good about their school and feel good about what they're doing, their friends, if what's coming across in the mother is, I remember one time, I don't remember what it was about, but I do remember that I was very heavy-hearted about something. I really cannot remember what, years ago. And I must have been sighing very audibly. I really was. You don't often do it, but I like felt it in my heart. And my daughter, who was about 5 at that time, said to me, Mommy, what are all those noises about? Where are all those noises coming from? She was like, what are those sighs? And I was like, okay. I took a deep breath. I better stop this right now. My poor little girl has got to be heavy, weighted down with her mother's sighing. You know, that wasn't what I wanted. So, in other words, really, our mindset has to be, I'm here. This is where I can be, and I can fulfill Ratzon Hashem. What am I going to do? How am I going to make a difference in this community? How am I going to bring up a family in a way that everybody here, to the best of our ability, we will be raise children who are going to be happy, healthy, normal children in an environment, hopefully, of Kedusha in my home? How am I going to do that? But to sit and have the paradigm of, oh, such Mesiras Nefesh, I can't see that will bear any fruit that will be very valuable at all.
Is there any reason for any of us
us to feel like we're at an inherent disadvantage because we live out of town.
Listen to it. You know what? You know what? Again, I never felt an inherent disadvantage because I lived in Chicago. And trust me, Chicago was not then what it is today. I am living in Chicago for most of my married life. I lived in New York for 2 years. That's it, the beginning. My husband was learning in Ecole in New York, and then we moved to Chicago where he was learning. So I'm talking about Chicago a long time ago. I never felt that. Like, what? I can't imagine that that's going to bear any... I really can't. I'm, like, trying to think about this, stretch my mind over here. It does mean that you have to know that any... Like, what... We don't want to put down other communities and comfort ourselves by saying, well, Lakewood's got this problem, that problem, another problem, or Flatbush, or what? Right, right. But we don't really want to do that because that's not fair either. Right? Flatbush, blah, 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 Muncie, da, 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 blah, 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 blah. We don't want to live there. We try to comfort ourselves by pointing out all the disadvantages of all these other places. Let's face it, everyone, like, that's why I said earlier, every community's got its own challenges. And yes, Lakewood faces big challenges. On the other hand, Lakewood is a tremendous makom Torah. And people who sit there recounting all the disadvantages of Lakewood, I think that's so unfair. And it's probably being over on the Chafetz Chaim when he says, you're not allowed to speak to Shana about a community. I think Lakewood's a big community that you're not allowed to speak to Shana about. But people will enumerate all the chesronos of Lakewood right there. And I come into Lakewood and I just feel that it's a makom Torah. I feel it so strongly. There's so much good in Lakewood as well. We can't discount that and put that down. At the same time, we have to know they're facing their own challenges. So what are we doing? It's about when it's all boils down to, it's about me and my family, and I'm not trying to say the Sviva doesn't have any power. It has so much power. I really know that, and I've really tried to address that somewhat tonight. But you know, the pasuk that says Ki chizak b'cheish arayach beirach banayach b'kir beich. So I heard in the name of Rabbi Avraham Azman, the Riverdale Rosh Hashiva, a person who's machazik, the brichesh arayach, their own gates, the locks of their gates, their home. You strengthen your home, beirach banayach v'kirbech. Your children will be mevorachim, will be blessed in your kirbech, v'kirbech, in your midst. We have to do it. You cannot possibly, and it might mean that you have to do something like send your kids away to camp. My parents sent me away to Camp Enos on the East Coast when I was 9 years old. Now, I don't recommend that for anybody. It was not fun. Okay, 9-year-old, and I was a pretty feisty little kid, and I could stand up for myself, but I was the only out-of-towner in the entire Camp Enos. Try that one on for a size. The only, okay? And my father said, if I am raising you in the city of Chicago, you've got to see if there's life out of Chicago. You've got to see that. And not only that, my parents couldn't afford camp in those days. My father used to write articles for the Jewish Observer in exchange for his daughters being able to go to camp. They made him write a certain amount of articles at every edition of the Jewish Observer. He was writing articles all year long so he could send us to camp. And he would come and drive us up to the Catskills because no one was flying in those days. And he didn't have money for that, so he would drive us up and with real atmospheres, I would call it atmosphere. I was never some part of parents. And I was 9 and 10 when I went to Camp Enos till I was 15 years old. And then I said, I am done with Camp Enos. And Camp Enos is a great camp, don't get me wrong, but it was not, you know, a lot of New Yorkers here. And I was, Anyways, I guess we made our mark as Chicagoans, the Keller sisters that came up there, and you know, we, whatever it was. Anyways, but I'm saying, so you might have to compensate, you might have to do different things, you might have to. There are things parents have to take into a cheshbon and figure out what they're going to do about it. But bottom line is that you have to, at an inherent disadvantage, if a person is really feeling that way, I'm not sure why they're not sitting down and having a very serious conversation with their husband and saying, we're at a very inherent disadvantage. We need to talk about relocating. I'm serious. You cannot live in a place where you feel you are at an inherent disadvantage. You cannot stay there. It is not good for you, it's not good for your marriage, it's not good. It's so, so detrimental to your shalom bias and to your children. What are you doing? What are you doing? Where is that, you know? So now if you say, well, I can have a conversation with my husband because we just moved here 3 months ago and my husband ain't gonna listen to me. Well then, give it a little more time, take a deep breath or many deep breaths and hold on, you know, but that's what I would say. So, I don't know if I answered your question, but yeah.
Can I make a short comment? I once called upstairs, because I was complaining about something with the school, And he said to me, just very, you know, plain, and he says, you know, I went to a one-room schoolhouse, and I turned out pretty good.
That's what he said?
I was a friend, the two of us were talking about some issue with school. He says, you do what you can. He says, we in Philadelphia do what we can, and then you have to just, you know, you'll be
supplement.
Okay. Yes.
And you'll be okay. Very interesting. Yes.
I don't have a specific question, but do you have any good ideas that being in that town could be lonely? Like, having the choices of friends compared to people in big cities. So even as a little kid, and then when you get married also, there's not a lot of people that are, there's not a lot of choices of friends.
Right. So, and sometimes that can be very difficult sometimes.
If three girls in the class, and then them two are cliques,
that can be really, really difficult. It really can, and you need to understand that for your child. I don't think you're talking about a community like that here, where there's only two girls in a class, or and they're a clique.
We are.
Oh, we are.
Oh, yeah. There's two girls in a class. It's that they're sort of in three communities.
Oh, two girls on your side of town or your side of town.
Right.
What I've seen happen is that these kids become good friends with kids older than them, younger than them. There's such a strict division in most classes that seventh graders only talk to seventh graders, and they look at the sixth graders, they're so babyish, you know. Okay, imagine that you were a sixth grader last year, but you were also so babyish, you know. So I'm saying, I see where you can develop really nice relationships with kids of different ages, and maybe kids who aren't even in the same school as your kid, you know. But I find that once women are married in a community, yes, you need to reach out. And some people, it's harder because they're shyer or they're not that extrovert who's out there partying all the time and going to every event of the COLO or every event of whatever it is. And some people are, but I find that mothers are so busy. That doesn't mean you don't need friends. You need friends. Let's say that very emphatically. You need friends. Every woman needs to have friends. Someone she can really, really, you know, relate to, talk things over with, really on a real level. Everybody needs that, right? But, you know, I don't think we need, like, all of a sudden a gaggle of friends. I think we need one or two good friends that you feel you can really relate to and be with and spend time with and go play with your kids together or whatever it might be. So I don't know that I have any answers, but, yeah, maybe. Yes.
One of the big things I'm hearing you say about the difference between discount and outcome is not called strong yogurt, but more like what we are exposing ourselves and our children to being in an out-of-town community. And so I was questioned this morning by someone who's not religious, and now I guess I put the idea more in my head as we have this discussion, of to what extent, I think if you're living in a city where you're saying, like, where it feels more enclosed is what you're really saying, is an in-town community versus an out-of-town community is it's more open. To what extent do we, as mothers, allow our children to expose a little more because we're living in an out-of-town community? It sounds like from a lot of your stories, like, your father was very straight, like, we're staying here, we're not budging, this is where we're holding. Versus, I've heard a lot of times from other people, like, you have to go along with what your child, the speaker you're putting your kid in, they're going to, like, give them the arms to be able to deal with it, so we allow them to do, maybe have a little more exposure. Like, how do you balance that?
I mean, that's a really good question. And I just want to point out that while you're probably right, it seems like we were just very sheltered and not exposed. No, that's fine. And my father did have the standards, and we were going to keep those standards, but I don't think that we really, I mean, I do think that growing up in Chicago, we were more aware of the world. I once described myself as a teacher. I described myself to one of my principals. I said, well, I am a broad-minded kanai. Those were the words that I used. That's really how I see myself. I am a broad-minded kanai. In other words, kanai meaning that these are my standards, and I, Baruch Hashem, I'm zocha right now to be the principal of Beis Yaakov, and I run a Beis Yaakov, and I have standards of a Beis Yaakov, but I am an open-minded kanai. In other words, I understand the people from all walks of life. I get it. And I know that with my students who are not all, I tell them I'm not looking for you to be cookie cutter and be Mr. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so. That's not what I'm looking for you to be. You need to be who you are and aspire to great things, but you do not have to think you should be the same. So I'm saying, that's what I'm saying. I do feel that having grown up out of town, gives me that open-mindedness. And it's interesting because my sister is the principal in Lakewood. I mean, people say about her, boy, she is so normal. That's what they'll say about her. Because why? Because probably because she grew up in the same, you know, family, and it was like an approach of being healthy and normal and open-minded to other people, but knowing that we had standards for ourselves. So I'm just pointing that out. Your question, should we be allowing our children more exposure? It's a really tough question. It's a
movie. Watching Frozen. There you go.
I would think so, and there will definitely. Does anybody want to respond to that? By the way,
I think that a parent has to decide what's okay with them because of their beliefs, and then they could, if a certain movie, no matter which company makes it, is not comfortable for them, then wherever they're living, they cannot let their child see it. They don't think it's a good movie for their kid, if they don't think movies are good for their kid, you know, or sitting in front of screens, even if it's Jewish movies. The parent needs to decide if they're comfortable with it or not. And they made the choice to live there. Their child is not, like, can't be the carbon to what they chose to do. Like,
but the carbon in which way?
So, the carbon, like, since I live here, you are going to be allowed to watch things that I really am not comfortable with.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that, I think, you know, Mrs. Manis, you really said, like, it's not a matter of no, it's a matter of replacing. Like,
right.
We have to have better fun and more better things, and we do much more fun than that. Fun might not be the right word, but we have much better
fun. Fun is a great word. What's wrong with fun? I love fun.
Okay, so
I like fun.
So replace rather than remove. But I think that, like, in response to what Deborah was asking, Deborah question was asking about how you unite this aloof attitude.
Yeah.
I think that we understand that everybody has different struggles, so you might see someone failing in their struggle, but I'm failing in my struggle sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they may be struggling whether to watch a video or not, and we're not even thinking about that, but we might be failing in other mitzvos and other things.
Right.
So, like, it's not, we don't become aloof because who knows who's better in Hashem's eyes.
Okay, but at the same, right, okay.
So what we're saying to our children and to ourselves, and I think that's really the key, is what we think for ourselves. What we say to our kids, the words is like,
yeah.
You know, it's mostly the actions and the attitude and the body language. But I think that what we're saying is, like, we make choices. If I'm not comfortable with this movie, it doesn't matter how many children around are watching it. It's just not going to be something I can let my kid watch. But at the same time, of course not with the thing, like, our family is better. But, like, no, who knows? They are have a different background. And who knows what we stumble in,
but
they don't stumble in.
Okay, but wait, there's a response over here. Yes.
I think, though, what also happens, though, is that if your kid's not the one who watches the movie, and they're surrounded by the kids who do watch the movie, and they're in class with the kids who watch the movie, guess what? They know a lot about that movie.
Okay, so they can know about it.
Okay.
But it also influences them, and it creates a character of
them. And that has nothing to do with that account. Wherever children go.
Absolutely, but I'm just saying that's, you know.
Well, it does have to do
maybe, okay.
Yeah, it does have to do with out of town to some extent. I'm not saying, but it's much more in an in-town school, depending on what the school is, it might be very much more covert, undercover. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. Yes.
How do you deal with the question
that
sometimes our families that are
perceived
at
the
higher level that do things like you
were? That's tough. That's really, really tough. That is really, really tough. Because, because she said, how do you deal with a situation where another family that's supposed to be a very chashuv family or a higher level family, thank you so much, is doing things that you have told your children are not for your family? Right? I'm sorry?
Even the same.
Right. Or, you know, like another Kolo family or another, you know, Rav and the Rav, whatever it is. I mean, their family's doing it and I don't want my children to do it, right? So how do you deal with that? And that's tough. It really is tough because, again, it has to be, and I think Abigail's right, it doesn't matter the words we say, it has to be that we give over. It's not like we're looking at, oh my gosh, so that person, because they, you know, how these high ones have fallen because they have fallen into, look what happened to them after living for 5 years in Denver, you know. So you, if you're going to be feeling that way, your kids are going to get that. They really are, you know. And your question is a really, really good one. And I don't have an answer for it. I think what this discussion is a very important one because I think that, yes, there will be people who live in communities like Denver, like Chicago, like South Bend, Indiana, like Cincinnati, and their kids will not watch Frozen. They just will not. And Frozen is a Disney movie. I don't. All I know is that I keep seeing Frozen all over the place. I have no idea what the heads are about, but I'm sure it's not. I am sure it's not inappropriate as movies go. As movies go, let's put it that way. What? No, it is?
Oh,
I didn't know that. But I'm saying, but there will be families that will say, no, like, again, like, this is our standard, and we're going to, this is not, now, will kids sometimes sneak away and see a movie at someone else's house? Yes, but that would be anywhere, and you can't avoid that. So, and they'll feel pretty guilty about it if you have a good relationship with them. You know, a lot of this is about, I didn't talk about this enough, because I talked about it this morning much more so. A lot of this is about your relationship with your child. And what we have to do is strengthen that relationship and let them feel the love and let them feel the just the outpouring of attention and love and giving to children. Because what I said this morning was that to your child, you represent the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To a certain extent, you are a HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a very long period of their lives. And then eventually you come to be representing a HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? So if you can strengthen more of your relationship with your child, then it's not a specific answer to your question or answer to your question either, you know? It's so important that it cannot be conveyed with, oh, so they let their kids go over to someone else's house and watch television. And when I go to someone else's house, I'm told very clearly that I'm not going to look at that TV, right? And my parents trust me that I'm not looking at that TV, but I see that so-and-so, Mayor Schwartz goes over and he's sitting there glued to the screen and I see it, you know? And when I say, you know, and sometimes little kids aren't really out there. So they're like, how come your Tati lets you watch TV? You know, like they'll say that straight. And, well, either he does or he doesn't, you know, but whatever. So I don't have any, you know, real answers. I will tell you, I'm like debating whether I should say this, but I'm going to say it. It wasn't such a terrible thing, but I'm like thinking back to a time when one of my children, two of my sons actually really, really wanted to go to a Cubs baseball game. Now, my sons are, you know, already grown men with children of their own, so this is quite a while ago. And they were about, I don't know, 12, maybe 12, 11, I don't remember. And I was really, really debating with my son. My husband and I talked about it long and hard. They wanted to go so badly. And their friends were going, and their friend's father was taking them, and a responsible adult, and all the whatever. And I didn't want my kids at a Cubs game in a big, bad way. But that's where I said to them, in that case, I said to them, okay, so let's sit down and talk about it. And we talked about it, pros and cons, blah, blah, blah. I left the decision up to them. I would love to say they didn't go, they went to the Cubs game. I would love to say, guess what, my angelic little boys and my love did not go to the Cubs game. They went, the Cubs won, and they never asked me to go back to a game again. That was it. It was done. Now I guess so. If they would have, I know, but I'm saying, but you see, at that point, we had to make a judgment, and it's not the same today. I mean, games are pretty bad today, and basketball games are known to be, I mean, from what I hear in Chicago, I don't know. You have a basketball team? You must, right? Uh-huh. All I know about is Denver Broncos. What?
It's a sports town
USA. It's a sports town USA. Okay. Whatever it is, but I think, you know, it wasn't what I wanted, but we made a judgment that to have them keep pushing and pushing and never be able to see that baseball game and always, you know, feel like they were cheated out of it, and they, you know, I have a friend who, when his kids wanted to go to some game or another, made a deal with them that they had to learn a certain amount of Mishnayos Baal Peh, I think it was, equal amount for the amount of time they were spending at that game. I'm like, that's interesting. I was not doing that one, but it was rather interesting. Yes, did you have a question?
Sometimes if the child is don't know if I'm saying this, if it's about to say this, but if they, like you say, if they go to that game and they saw it and they got it
out of their system,
then
But I don't know that I would have said the same about a movie. I don't know that I would have said the same about a movie at all. You know what I'm saying? I you know.
It depends what the little movies are that you see your...
Okay, I think we're going to come to a close over here. And
thank you very much. Thank you very much, Abigail.
As soon as people found out that I was going, so it was the fact is, it's inherently, there's an inherent disadvantage that people who come from New York automatically feel they have to proselytize and they have to teach you how to be a better Jew. So we, I'm not talking about me personally, I'm saying we as a community, okay, people who are trying to do as much as I do, right? They feel inherently a disadvantage. They feel like they are always lower in my train.
Thank you.
Okay.